thank you for listening to my Nightfall podcast. If you enjoy this content ahead, please check out my Instagram at nightfallstories04. And if you would like to send in a story of yours for me to narrate, please send it to nightfallstories04@gmail.com and let me know how to credit you. Thank you, and enjoy the stories ahead. For $3,000 a month, I do a night cleaning job on three conditions. One, I can't take a single day off. Two, the job lasts 365 days. And three, I have to follow all posted signs. If I can abide by those three things, I get a bonus of $5,000 at the end of my contract. To someone desperate for cash with no options, PCCA seemed like a great gig. I like working by myself, I rarely get sick, and since it's a night gig, I can pick up different jobs during the day and maybe one day not live paycheck to paycheck. I've had this job for 90 days, and it's starting to get weird. The conditions are easy, but the actual job, I can't really talk to people about it. They don't believe me. It's all right with me, really. I've always been a loner, but I need someone else to know about what's been happening. PCCA is a pretty underground business, Paranormal Containment Centers of America. I only found out about it through a sketchy online ad, and even there, they weren't upfront about what they do. The ad was for night cleaning for PCCA, Purification Chemical Compounds of America, and was labeled as mildly dangerous due to the nature of purification chemicals. The entire ad used vague technical jargon that I didn't care to research. The pay justified the nature of the job, and I needed the job. The night cleaning job is not an easy position to fill for a number of reasons, including but not limited to the nightly tasks. 1. Refilling the blood buckets in the vampire containment cave. 2. Mopping the area outside Nessie's tank, aka the splash zone, where the carnage of her dinner ends up. And 3. Sanitizing and cleaning the triple layer of doors outside the ghost ward. 4. Repairing any damage to the outer walls of the demon den. And lastly, 5. Using a shop vac to remove any unexplainable slime puddles, probably from the extraterrestrial floor. And that's just the first half of page 1. I go in at 5 and I'm usually done by 9 or 10, depending on Nessie's enthusiasm for mealtime or how feisty the ghosts are feeling. Last night, I went in and started to understand why there's a time limit on this job. Rule 3 is important because the signs change each shift. Most of the time, they're ones I've seen before rotated out. Caution, spirits imitating loved ones in distress. Think happy thoughts, aliens attempting mind control, or my favorite, scarecrows on prowl tonight. But I saw one tonight I hadn't seen before. As I walked in, the bright red sign caught my eye. Alert, shadow stealers active, exercise extreme caution. After 90 days, I had gotten more comfortable than I could have imagined with paranormal entities, but shadow stealers? I couldn't recall those. I thumbed through my employee handbook until I saw the section, Shadow Stealers, a comprehensive warning. I scanned the 3-page write-up and got the gist. Shadow stealers are rare, only emerging about once every 5 years. Shadow stealers are tough because the experts have yet to find a way to fully contain them, and they have some nasty habits. Shadow stealers follow your breath, and their primary goal is to steal it. They do this first by taking your shadow a few inches at a time. The experts still don't fully understand how, but once the shadow stealers have taken 75% of your shadow, breathing becomes more difficult. As they take the remainder of your shadow, you suffocate, and there's nothing anyone can do to help you. After they suffocate you, others in the building hear your breathing for hours, like your breath is following them. Highly dangerous and highly distressing. If you notice your shadow being consumed, you can try to fight back by walking into daylight and shifting your light source. Not an option for night shift, and at best, this option has a 50% success rate. Best not to get your shadow taken in the first place. The primary defenses: a mask covering your nose and mouth to deter them from following, and a headlamp to illuminate the space around you so you can always keep watch on your shadow. I saw in my daily supply bucket my two additions for the night waiting on me: a dark-colored mask and a fancy headlamp with lights all around. As I moved my head, the lights adjusted, allowing me to have an eye on my shadow no matter what my movements. I scanned the pages on Shadow Stealers one more time. If I had learned anything in 90 days, it was that being prepared for the paranormal was one of my utmost importances. After rereading, I grabbed my supplies and set to work. The handbook advises against using headphones during your shift. It's important to have full hearing in case an alarm sounds or an entity communicates with you, which requires lengthy documentation. I began sweeping my normal path and continually checking my shadow. I was on guard, but nothing seemed off. As I swept around the edges of the demon den, I tried to ignore the sound of long nails dragging across the wall on the opposite side. That's when I heard the sound of a mound of paperwork after my shift. A demon spoke to me. "What happens when they don't get your whole shadow?" it hissed from inside the den. I couldn't see, only see its glowing eyes through the darkened panes of glass. As instructed, I ignored it, despite the bone-chilling terror I felt. Employees were told to ignore any communications from the paranormal. We were told to make notes of all things said, all sounds, smells, tastes, and feelings, but never to speak back. "You don't have to speak to me. You don't need to. I can hear your thoughts," the demon said. It tapped a nail against the glass. I had only been spoken to a couple of times by entities, and I had never spoken back. I am a rule follower. The experts say that the things contained here will say anything to try to get you into a conversation. My hand shook as I continued sweeping.
"We will, madam. We will say anything," it said as its eyes followed me.
There is nothing like the feeling of being followed by a demon's eyes. I could feel the cold sweat down my back.
"What happens when it only takes half your shadow? When are you able to stop it? The shadow stealers are not far from my kind."
Would thinking back count as speaking? I couldn't really control my thoughts. I didn't remember reading about what happens if 50% of the shadow is taken and you succeed at fighting back.
"Oh, the experts, so high and mighty. Never seen here past daylight for good reason. Scared of our power. You're expendable to them. Why didn't they tell you what happens if your shadow is only half stolen?"
The words were more sinister, spoken in a whisper that sounded like it was right inside my ears, and made the hair on the back of my neck stand at attention. Why didn't they tell me? Why wasn't that in the handbook? Everything else was.
"Because they don't care what happens to you. I know what happens when the Shadow Stealers get to you. It doesn't matter if you fight. Once your shadow starts to go, your soul does too.
The entities will say anything to get you to speak back. Anything." "How do you think we got in this situation, in this cage? We used to be like you," the demon said. That statement made my stomach drop. I kept sweeping, checking my shadow. Still good. A few more feet of sweeping, and I could be done with the demon den for the night.
"Are you looking close enough? Are you really looking?"
Employees aren't to speak back to the creatures. I inspected my shadow. No. No, no, no. My wispy hairs that framed my head from my haphazard ponytail were gone from my shadow. I sprinted outside. The sun hadn't fully set. There was time to change my light source. I turned until my shadow was on the other side of me, stretched long. I watched as my hair slowly reappeared in it and realized I'd been holding my breath. I took a few deep breaths and examined my shadow. I was okay. Everything was okay. I just had to be more vigilant and not let any entities get to me. The experts are meticulous. I had to finish the tiny section of the demon den, then complete the rest of my duties. I began to speed sweep when the demon came back to the glass. Smart girl. So smart and so brave. You got your whole shadow back, but they got you. Your soul. They're part of you now. Demons are liars. It's in every file, every story I've ever heard. They lie. Humans lie too. You'll start turning soon. Just like us. The demon started laughing. I don't think I will ever get used to that sound. I finished the area and latched the hallway door leading to the demon den. I'd never been spoken to that much by anything in the center. I kept watching my shadow and moved on to the werewolf cages, my favorite area to clean. The werewolves were usually calm at night and looked a lot like big dogs to me. Lots of things frightened me in that place, but not the werewolves. As I rolled my mop bucket into the room, the werewolves began howling. They snarled at me, gnashed their teeth, and foamed at the mouth. I mopped the area despite their chomping at the bars. At least these guys couldn't try to talk to me. I finished up their enclosure and rolled to the vampire caves. All I had to do was drop some new blood buckets off from the donor freezer. As I began lowering them into the cave, I realized something was very wrong. The buckets smelled good, like really good, like I wanted to drink it. I wrapped up my duties there as quick as possible and sped through the rest of my shift. I just got home and I can't stop thinking about it. The blood smelled so good to me. I hate to even admit that. I didn't write in my documentation, even though I put everything the demon said to me. I am a rule follower, but maybe I can't be anymore. I keep replaying what the demon said to me about a piece of my soul, about being transformed. I really need this job. I really wish I didn't. My footsteps echo through the empty cafeteria before becoming muffled by the thick spread of fallen ballots fanning out from an overturned table. The white sheets are strewn haphazardly throughout the room, their upturned faces revealing the dark spots of ink-filled bubbles mixed with the spray of red droplets. I grip the stolen rifle tightly and walk faster, attempting, but failing, to avoid looking at the body sprawled across the floor to my right. The pool of blood still expanding from beneath the crumpled form has soaked in dark amber. A white sheet of paper adorned with printed block letters asking that all registered ballot counters sign in here. My heart is still beating rapidly in my chest, and my tongue feels as if it is made of aluminum. I don't know if the man whose uniform I am wearing is alive or dead. I remember the boneless way he crumpled after I struck him from behind, and I shudder, not sure of which I hope is true. I was in the bathroom when I heard the rise of voices, the sound of heavy military boots hitting the floor, and then the sudden, shocking sound of gunshots and screams. The recount had all come down to the state, the city. The news had become increasingly alarming as the uncertainty compounded and the conspiracy spiraled. Walking into my shift in the previous days, I had been forced to run a gauntlet of Hawaiian shirt-clad militia members who thronged the Ward 3 election district offices day and night. The sound of trucks revving, shouts of protesters, and clashes between factions were constant as we sorted through the thousands of thick sheets, diligently tallying the votes. The executive order sending the army to the streets of Philadelphia had been mired in controversy. But I had first heartened when this morning I filed past strings of silent men and women in army uniforms rather than the usual cacophonous crowd. That is until I had noticed the patches on their arms and the flags which unfurled from the tanks arrayed around the office. Peering out through a dirty window on the second floor, a spiderweb of cracks spreading from a bullet hole in its bottom pane, I see smoke sprouting throughout the city and hear screams and gunshots drifting through the cold November air. I watch those same flags snap in the bitter wind as the tanks jerk into motion to escort the large trucks into which the survivors had been herded. The milling mass of men below me seem to be in good spirits, their shouts and laughs rising up to me. A throng of brightly colored militia members intermixed with the army greens is splayed out before me. A parade of pickup trucks joins the convoy as it pulls away to the sounds of taunts and jeers from the crowd, and I watch the omnipresent blue and white flags, emblazoned with Trump 2020, roll past me. We were supposed to be the first colony on Mars, but not its last. Staring at the figures blinking softly on the screen, nobody said a word. "Maybe if we..." began Terrence before trailing off hopelessly. I watched it slowly dawn on the 12 members of our expedition. It wasn't possible. "If we just have a few more weeks, that last resupply would have..." "But we didn't." Kilo cut Samantha off, sharply, but not angrily. I looked out the viewport, the churned ground close to the base slowly giving way to smooth red emptiness and black sky. The white walkway leading to the nearly finished greenhouse glowed dully. Terrence wordlessly pressed a button on the dashboard. The black screen which loomed over us flicked on, but showed nothing but static. "We lost contact with Earth 5 days ago. 2 weeks after the last resupply rocket arrived, and 3 weeks after General Riker had seized Columbus from one of the three men claiming to be the President of the United States. At first, we had largely ignored the reports coming in from Earth. Superstorms, international instability, localized wars, and political gridlock were constant before we had left, and we had all had our reasons for leaving that increasingly hot and crowded blue dot behind for the thrill of taking part in Operation Phoenix. I remember feeling like the hopes of a whole species were riding on us when I stepped on the gleaming angular spaceship for the first time. The news coming in from Control had become increasingly concerning in almost direct proportion to the infrequency with which it arrived. The riots grew and spread, and the images of burning cities, crowds clashing in the streets, and emaciated children lining the highways of America filled our screens. One night, I came in after spending a frustrating day trying to figure out why the potato stems were wilting, to see Samantha sitting in the dark, her eyes wide and face wet, watching images of American aircraft carriers floating up the Hudson as smoke engulfed the New York skyline. We were close, so close. Just a few more materials, a little more time, and we might have made this place self-sustaining. Thomas was the first to do it. We found him the next morning, sitting outside with his legs crossed and his helmet open. His eyes were shut, and he looked peaceful. He was not the last to choose this option, rather than wait for the life support to give out or the food stores to dwindle. As I slowly grow weaker, I lay on my back looking at the stars. The same stars I glimpsed faintly as a child during the power outages that often swept through the Calcutta slums. I would stare at those bright dots through the overhanging roofs and tangled wires and imagine escaping the urban jungle I grew up in to the stars. Now that I finally had, the jungle had grown to swallow the whole world. The story takes place when I was 19 years old. I was working part-time as a cashier at a Whole Foods. If you've never heard of Whole Foods, it's really just a healthy grocery store. I was working my usual evening shift. It was about 6 p.m., and the business of the store started to pick up. My line, as well as everyone else's, were getting full. It was at this time a young girl with long dreaded hair comes through my line. I say my usual greetings as I scan her items. Halfway through my small talk cashier banter, she ends up telling me that she lives in Maui. I ask her what she does, and she said that she works on a fruit and coffee farm. I told her that sounds fantastic, and I jokingly asked her if they were hiring. Obviously, not really expecting her to take me seriously. Well, to my surprise, right at that moment, she's writing down a name and number on a small piece of paper. She said to call this number and asked to talk to a man named Chuck. Very surprised, I took the paper and I thanked her. Later that night, I told a few of my friends about what happened. We end up looking up the phone number to see if it was a real business. Turns out it was, and for the sake of the story, they're called Organic Fruit. What they do is let travelers, or woofers, come and stay on the land for labor on the fields. In this case, it was meaning harvesting all the fruits and coffee on the field. I got very excited about the opportunity, and so did my friend Stephanie. Stephanie had been my friend for a couple of years, and we had always enjoyed hanging out with each other, so we thought this would be a cool experience. She actually ended up working out things and left before I did. So I got my flight, packed my bags, and within 3 months, I headed out. Fast forward about another 3 months, and we were still trying to get settled into island life. We slept in tents on the farm and did hard labor in the day, so it was an adjustment for sure. The biggest change for me personally was having to hitchhike 90% of the places we went. This farm was located in the middle of Hana Highway, about 7 miles away from Hana Town Center, so we'd have to hitch rides to where we wanted to go, which, being white Americans walking down the road with book bags and our thumbs out, didn't help at times. The locals could be nasty to tourists, especially if the tourists might overstep in some way. The land is very important in Hawaii, especially in Maui, and tourists can be, well, thoughtless. But nothing could prepare me for what was going to happen one night. Me and Stephanie had befriended a guy named Joey. He was there doing the same thing as us. He was 26 and from Dallas, Texas. One day we decided to spend our day off hitchhiking down Hana Highway and then sleep on Hana Bay. We would wake up in the morning and get coffee at the coffee shop right on the water. So we packed our bags, filled our water bottles, and we headed out. It was a really pleasant walk there. Maui is unbelievably scenic at all times of the day. It's hard not to stop and look at everything you see. We eventually made it to Hana Bay about 9 p.m. We laid our stuff on the beach and laid in the sand to rest our feet. Then Joey mentioned he had a bowl packed, so we headed to the covered patio area to smoke. We were all three feeling relaxed, joking around with ourselves, and then when about 20 minutes in, we see headlights come down the gravel drive leading to the parking lot of Hana Bay. We hid the weed and acted cool. We felt better when we saw it was just three locals getting out, grabbing racks of beer from their trunk. They were just here to basically chill, so we stayed put. The three put their beer on the table. We saw it was one woman and two men. One man was larger with tattoos while the other wore sunglasses, a long-sleeve shirt, and board shorts. The larger man put his 30 rack of beer on the table right across from us, all the while looking at us in a very confrontational way. I noticed he then started to eye Stephanie, who was sitting on the bench seat, up and down. Without saying a word, he then proceeds to sit right behind Stephanie on the bench and grab her breasts. While doing this, he eyes me and says, "So what's up? You guys on my fucking area?" Stephanie looked completely terrified, so I had to tell him that she was my girlfriend, even though she wasn't, just so he would stop. He then looks at me and sarcastically says, "Oh, that's your girlfriend? Sorry, man." All the while, having a smug smile on his face. Me and Joey grab Stephanie and head over to the water, where our sleeping bags were set up. We calmed Stephanie down and eventually decided to keep to ourselves. We fell asleep, and about an hour later, I woke up to the sound of loud laughter. I then see Stephanie sitting up looking nervously at the covered patio. "They took our stuff," she said. I looked over to see our shoes and book bags missing. I woke Joey up and told him we had to get our stuff back, but nervously, we confidently walked up to the group and asked if we could just get our stuff back. The large guy laughs and points at the trash can. "There it is, Howley." The group eventually left a few hours later, and we got a few hours of sleep. A couple months later, I head back home, and I'm very grateful for the experience we were given. I think about what happened from time to time, and I hope no one ever really got hurt by that guy. I strongly suggest advising extreme caution if you're tracking outside tourist locations in Maui, especially at night. So, sinister locals, let's not meet. Hello everyone, and thank you for checking out another Nightfall podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed the stories I got from Reddit No Sleep, and I'd like to take a minute to thank all the Reddit users who let me narrate their stories. The Shadow Stealers are really messing up the vibe of my night cleaning job, by Reddit user That Art Teacher Lady. The Center Can't Hold, and Some of Us Are Looking at the Stars, by Reddit user Bleep Bloop 1990. And the last story you heard, Sinister Locals, was written by me, based on true events. And I think my cat liked to say hello to everyone. Thanks again, everyone. Have a good night.